All right, so there was no homework. I did suggest that you guys start working on your game projects and basically getting some shader, something in there. So who has gotten, you know, something working or at least tried?
People.
Okay. Well, you know, you had a question answered. Done. Moving on. Answered, right?
Yeah.
Pretty much. Okay. So anytime, you know, you guys have any questions, you can always, like, send me what you have. Tell me what's the problem. I mean, don't bang your head against the homework. It is not productive past a certain point. Okay? All right. Yes, yes. So I kind of figured that maybe today we would try and do... I even have a little audio. Maybe not. Stupid thing is overpowering the laptop. So I sort of figured, you know, would do a little more hands-on today. I mean, we're going to go through some slides, but I'm also going to show you a few things in the game project, in source code, you know, how things work, basically get you ready for the next homework, which there is today. You know, starting from today, we're going to basically be doing our homework on the game project. So, you know, we'll need to get on with that. So...
I assume using the download from your game is fine.
Hmm?
Using starting with the download...
Yes, starting with that is fine. We put it there for... So you guys can don't have to be stuck with a game project that maybe's gone south or unmanageable. There's one thing in here that's kind of interesting. You know, this sort of like rays going out from the center of the screen on that image. You know, I've actually done something like that in the game project. You know, as an example of bling that you can add in games. So this is all cutscene and I can see everything.
You play inverted?
Yes. Of course. There's no other way. It's a religious thing. Must do. Okay. Okay, two things that are kind of interesting about that. You know, fade to white. How do you do that?
You just put white everywhere? So
yeah, you set a timer and then the white just...
What? Timer?
Well, because it gradually fades out, so you have to have some amount of time that's passed. And then...
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to animate
a
fade value that goes from, like, 0 to 1 or something. Yes, and then what do you do with it?
You put a rectangle in front of the camera and paint it white?
Right? I wouldn't even say that you put it in front of the camera.
Oh, turn off the
view. You just do, like, you know, X, Y, Z, R, H, W, or something like that. And, you know, forget about the camera. Just... put a rectangle on the entire screen and alpha blend it. And just move the alpha value.
And 0 to 1 over time.
Yeah. You don't even need a texture. You know, it's just a color, right? The color is white. The alpha is moving, right? And with that, you do fades like that. Kind of same thing with, you know, the cinematic bars that they put over here. I don't know if you saw it. There was like black bars at the top and bottom. You can render the whole scene and then paint that, or you can use the viewport. The viewport is a piece of data that you give to D3D, and it specifies, remember that when we set a projection matrix, and it kind of turns everything into like negative 1:1 on the X and on the Y, after the division by W that the GPU does, right? So the viewport says where that negative 1 and that positive 1 go on the screen. So you can specify any rectangle on the screen that receives that image. So you can muck with your projection matrix to change the aspect ratio because, you know, you're reducing it in height in this case and appropriately changing the viewport so that it only renders that portion. The rest can be just part of the clear at the beginning of the frame. Makes things a little cheaper because you are rendering less, right? Okay, so first thing, you can see that there is lighting going around, and this lighting is diffuse or specular, is it?
Specular.
Yeah, there is a lot of specular here. You can see, you know, this thing changes as I move around. Suddenly, it's not so white anymore, just because it's not reflecting the light anymore. Okay.
Do you know if it's points or regression? Is it point matching where we see the lights?
Okay, so if it gets white when I'm here, then it must be coming from over there. you know, that's probably kind of the light source. At this point, it's probably directional. I mean, I wouldn't do that as a point light. You'll notice that it has a halo around it. You know, it's probably just bright in that case. It just makes it so, you know, it looks like it's bright over there. Not just white. So, let's just move around. My goodness, I've forgotten. Huh? Oh. The other side. This thing. Oh my goodness, I forgot completely. So. Stand on the red square. There you go. Target each of the flashing lights.
Until it turns
green. There. Oh my goodness, I've forgotten everything or what? See, I didn't play this last night. You know, there are things that happen a little bit later in the game that I really want to show you and talk about. Here is some transparency over there. Anyway. Yeah, so then you need to go here.
So would the glowing stuff be sprites?
They talk?
Yeah,
those are basically sprites or some geometry with fuzzy textures in it. You know, like all these dots falling, that those are definitely sprites. The circles, you know, they're it's probably just like a quad that's coming down like this. See, when they get in the middle, you know, they're paper thin, right? So it's just basically one triangle like this with a texture with a ring in it. Basically, I mean, the... Oh. Yes. Come on. Let me out. Freaking. There. See? Those are the... Yeah. What? Blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of stuff about animation and scanning, you know, which we'll do in a couple of weeks. But another thing that's kind of interesting, you see, he's kind of mirrored. You know, like the left side is the same as the left side. You know, just ways of saving memory in textures, right? Not duplicate things that are the same or very close. Okay, you see this thing here? This is probably some geometry that's laid on top of the floor geometry. Okay, it's not just a texture with this painted on it.
Why would that be?
How can I tell? Well, okay, so I guess I can't really, except that this texture seems to be lower resolution than this one. You can see the, you know, the pixels over there are bigger than the pixels on this one. That's one telltale. The texture is binary filtered, and then it has alpha, and it has alpha testing. Because those edges are sharp, even though the pixels here seem to be not very sharp. Okay, so it's just an alpha-tested texture on top of things. This is tricky. Okay. When you have one piece of geometry, right, and maybe like arbitrarily big triangles, like a, say you're rendering a room and the entire floor of the room is one quad, two triangles. I mean, why make it more? You know, as long as it's just flat, right, and it just has a texture mapped on top of it, why not just do the whole thing one single triangle? You know, one single quad. But then if you want to draw something on top of it, okay, it is easy to get into z-buffering issues. The problem is when you have, let's say you have the floor over here like this, right? And this is two triangles, right? And then you're rendering something here, small, okay? When these vertices get processed, the Z values that the vertex shader generates, which are Z and W, and the GPU will divide them and so on, will not be generally the same as the Z values generated by the rasterizer when rasterizing these triangle here. It is floating point. Floating point is lossy. Errors happen and accumulate. Okay, so what ends up happening is the Z values that you get out of rasterizing these two triangles here sometimes will be slightly above and sometimes slightly below the Z values that you get from this triangle here. So your pixels will flicker. Show you an example of that later. Not exactly like this, but it shows you how the Z values can flicker. Okay. So the idea is you need to somehow modify those Z values so that when you render these two triangles over here, the Z values that the rasterizer gets are always closer to the camera than the ones from this triangle here. Okay. There are two render states that deal with that. Depth bias is the main one. It's basically a value that gets added to the Z values in the rasterizer. It's just a plain, like, offset to the Z values. So that you can say, oh, these Z values, you know, just subtract 4 from them. You know, 4 units. And there's another one, which is depth, slope, scale, bias. And that one is a little more complicated. The thing is, the more edge on the triangles are, the more your Z values will fluctuate. So just adding a constant bias may work in some, you know, from some camera directions, but not from others. when you're looking at these floor from above, maybe small bias is enough. But when you're looking at it from down below, like cat view, then probably your z values will start fluctuating again, even though you have applied some bias. And then you say, oh, I need more bias and more and more and more. Okay. And, where is the limit? What this thing does is, basically it applies a bias that depends on, how fast the z values are changing at that pixel. So if the triangle is edge on, you'll get a big bias. And when it's flat, you will get no bias at all from it. So usually you would use a combination of the two. And usually you don't calculate the values. You just experiment with them until you find values that work. Okay. Nope. There. Okay. Moving on. That thing over there. So how did it do that? Is it per pixel lighting? Huh?
Some kind of spotlight source?
Actually, more like a texture. Just, they just have a texture with a blob of light, and then they calculate where to map it. So when rendering geometry over here, the pixel shader gets an extra texture, which is a light texture. It gets calculated in this case from there. You'll see that they've been careful not to put two of those in the same place. Right? So yeah, that's basically just the texture.
Which
feature? Oh, that like spinning light, all these light flashes over here and this one's up there. It's basically, the same as this. It can be rendered as just a decal. This is called a decal. So it can be rendered as a decal. But if you want it to wrap around geometry like this, you need to render the geometry with that texture, basically. The texture coordinates need to be calculated as, where the corners of the texture would go from the point of view of the light.
So if you remember my game, I had those conveyor belts. I just did those a straight texture map and just changed the value of time linearly. And I gave the illusion of movement. This is more complex.
It's a little more complex, especially because what you're doing is you're projecting a cone, right? A pyramid from a single point into geometry. That has a lot to do with perspective correction. In fact, you have to do perspective correction on the texture coordinates yourself in order for it to look good. Especially if you're like shining a flashlight, right? Which is just like a round blob of light. And, if I'm shining it from here and it falls on the table, right? This will be a very elongated kind of thing. So.
Is it just performance? Like, why don't they just use lights?
Well, this is the original Xbox. The pixel shader was 8 instructions. Right? This gives it a lot of detail to the light for very cheap. Just for a texture. To do to for textures. So. No, the light bulb is just some light bulb geometry over there, with a sprite. Okay, so let's see.
Oh.
Yeah. Probably because this geometry is not that detailed. Again, this is an older machine, so the sparks are nice and You know, these are more, you know, like blobs just splatter on the floor. Those are just sprites. Just well done. And there's a certain art to doing special effects well, right? Okay, let's just move this on. Yeah. Wait, which way was this? See those, you know, when the aliens kind of fire on the walls, you know, you see kind of splatters of light over there. What the? Which way? Oh my goodness, I forget. I've played this so many times. Okay.
Oh, the blood on the floor doesn't look that realistic.
Hmm?
The blood on the floor doesn't look that.
No, not really. I mean, it's just a splat. Very low resolution, kind of splat.
I haven't seen
very
that
fuzzy.
Blood on the floor in my life.
Yeah. Yeah, you can see, yeah, there are aliens firing their weapons over there. Oh, okay, we're safe now. Too close. Okay. You see this thing here? Those shelves. Okay, there's something fake about them. When you see them edge on, you know, they get kind of blurry. That's because they get mipmapped. That's just the texture with alpha testing on it. Yes. Hey, construction sidewalks first. Yeah. It's kind of nice that they can have several of those things as long as they're separate. Let's see, where am I? No, the spinning lights. Not this way. My goodness, I'm too close. I'm getting dizzy. Yes, so I can shoot. Shoot. Okay. Hello. You're late?
Yeah.
Yeah, so see the bullet holes? They're also just, you know, a little quad rendered on top. They're just decals. And they're typically done like that, just decals.
So by decal, you kind of mean a texture over a specific...
Just,
area.
Yeah. Just something, you know, like a sticker on the wall. This was the way. Yeah. I'm going to ignore them completely. Because I don't care. No. Of course I keep getting lost. Oh. Cannot ignore them. I put in easy, so you know they shoot basically pellets. Yeah. Just want to get out of here. Yeah. Everybody die. That just makes me invincible. Okay. We have the most horrible bug in here. need me to. That's forever to fix. Basically, there's a place over there where they actually have some texture, some pretexture constants, which are nans, not a number, you know, which they're kind of hard to deal with. Lost again. Leave it. This way? Or am I going backwards? Okay, people are shooting here, so that's good. Yeah, that's another.
So is the flashlight just this?
Yeah, basically the same thing as the lights spinning. Same thing. Just the texture that gets splattered from a point of view. Was this? No. Goodness. Checkpoint. Did not remember this being so long. Yes. Kind of neat also the panes of glass. You can see they actually have a very thin texture on them. So when you move around, you know, you actually can see the glass, that it's there.
Oh, the cloudiness.
Yeah, just a little. Very, very faint, very subtle. No. I need to get one of those. No? Yes. Oh, yes. Flashlight. Basically, when it samples the texture, when it samples the texture, it basically decides whether, you know, just adds to the light of the. I see green. Yeah. Oh. I used to know my like way around this man. I don't know wherever I need to go. Huh. You know these? Well, can't go through this one.
No, that's red.
Yeah. That one is green.
Okay, go straight.
But it just went through that one and there was nothing.
Bash the door, I think.
No. Oh. Oh.
And then bash the door.
Oh, you freaked out.
Yeah. This way. Hello.
How are you?
Okay. Yeah.
We're actually loud.
Yeah. Video games, graphics. Okay, let's see. This way. Yeah, we remember that one. Okay. Okay, so I'm lost again.
Left. Huh? Straight.
Straight this way.
Left through the hatch. There you go. Turn on the light.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Another one of those.
Yeah. Okay.
This one or that one? Yeah.
Don't forget to shoot the marines.
Okay, so I'm probably going this way. Just ignore them. They're harmless. No. Ah! Am I going circles?
A little bit.
A little bit. Good. Okay. This way? Yeah. That's where it came from. That's where it came from. Maybe. Maybe this way? Here. Maintenance. Come on.
Pretty,
this is the way you have to go. It's
not a
standard. Yeah. There you go. Not this one. Here. Okay. All the cinematics are also pretty cool. All right.
Okay. Yeah, were these cinematics done?
The cinematics are all basically the engine rendering stuff. Hmm? You know, it's just the engine rendering the same graphics that you see while you're playing. It's just that they're driven through pre-canned animations. Animation is a pending subject that we have. I mean, what is an animation? What is an animation?
The models over time.
Well, the models, if it's a model animation. Basically, an animation is changing something over time. Usually changing a value or more values over time. Hmm. That's all there is to it. You change the camera, you know, the camera matrix. It's going to change the camera position, X, Y, and Z, three independent values. They get animated separately. You change the camera orientation, usually three angles. Roll, pitch, and yaw angles. You change the position, orientation of objects in the world, all of that stuff. So, yeah, I mean, that thing is just a whole bunch of values being changed all over the time, all over the place. You know, animations like those probably have cues in terms of, oh, you know, need to make sure that this is loaded because we're going to use it in a few, you know, in a second, that sort of thing. Okay. This gets a little... Huh?
So they're not just pre-rendering it and throwing it into an MPEG or something?
No, not in this case, no. Nice thing about this is it occupies a lot less memory. Uses the same graphics that the same models and textures and everything that you use during the game, so it doesn't take you out of the game. Pre-rendered, you can make them very, very beautiful, but you know they can take you out of the game. You just saw a little blurring here. Okay, so the screen was completely blurred, and then again, it's kind of like the fade in, right? it's basically applying a blur filter to the entire screen, and it's changing the width of the filter down to nothing. You know, so it animates that particular value. Same as the fade to white, but instead of changing the alpha, just changing a parameter of the filter. There was one thing that I kind of wanted you to see because it was an extremely cool thing that they did in this game. And that's honestly the main reason why I've gone through all the game through here. I probably should have done it at home first, but one first thing is lens flares. Lens flares is a very interesting artifact of the lenses of a camera. I mean, you can read all about it, and people who are serious about photography know about lens flares and why they happen. And in games, they're typically just faint 2D sprites like this. They're not in the scene. You know, they're an artifact of the lens itself, of the camera. Okay, so they're not part of the scene. They don't get like view and projection matrix. And what happens is you have a light source that's supposed to be very bright. And that light source contains a line of lens flares. And those lens flares can be any random assortment of faint sprites like those. Okay. And it is a line of those that goes from the light source on the screen through the center of the screen, because lens flares kind of follow the center of the camera. Okay. So if I move like this, you know, this is the line. It goes through the center of the screen, which is right here. They also are supposed to fade out when, you know, the light source is not on the screen anymore. And it's just 2D sprites. You know how to render a 2D sprite, right? A 2D rectangle on the screen. So you just need to know where on the screen is your light source, which is basically applying your projection matrix and doing the correct projection yourself instead of letting the GPU do it, just for that one point. If you have like the X, Y, Z of your light source, then that's what you do. If the light source... you're rendering it, so you know you have at least some point that represents that light source, even if it affects the scene only as a directional light, which does not have a point. When you render it, you have to render it somewhere. Okay. Once you have that, just to, you know, get that position, apply the view matrix, the projection matrix, and then divide by the W. That gives you the X and Y of that in the screen.
So if I heard you correctly,
once you have that, you have the points the position of the center of the screen, right? She's in viewport coordinates is like 0, 0, right? Remember, -1 to 1, -1 to 1.
Mm-hmm. And so I assume you're saying the sunlight that we see is just a directional light. But
yeah.
The sun that we see is probably emissive material.
Yeah, so the light that we see shining on this thing from over there, or shining on the weapon, right? Is that, you know, basically comes from that direction somehow. Okay. But the thing is, this actually has a position on the screen. Mm-hmm. So once you have found that, just, trace a line between that and the center of the screen.
Now, I noticed something on the water. Can you walk for me?
In 1 minute. There's another thing that's very interesting about this light source, and that is the God rays. Okay. Now, that's a tremendously cool effect. And it's kind of similar to the one it does on the loading screen. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's basically...
What are those called? What rays?
Those are like... Well, they're called God rays, typically. They're basically rays coming out of basically a bright light source that shines through leaves or through something that has holes in it. Mm-hmm. And what you see is that. You know, you see there's a God ray over here, another one over there, and so on. What they did here is also very ingenious. Okay? What they did is they rendered the sun with a very special color that they made sure that was nowhere else on the screen. Right? And then they took this rectangle as a texture. Okay? They basically got the scene as a texture after rendering that. And basically rendered it again, but changing that color into a white, bright color. And then they render it again, a slightly bigger rectangle, basically scaled up from the center of the light source. So they render it like this, and then 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 like this. And because they actually are only rendering those pixels that were visible of the sun, okay, you get, you know, those sort of beams radiating out through the leaves, which is, I don't know, it's pretty cool, I believe. It's one of those little tricks that people kind of figure out. So, anyway, you were talking about the water?
Seems like there's a reflection of the sun on the water. Is that just a fixed painting?
Yeah, it's kind of like a painting. It's not quite. I mean, you can see that it's kind of, you know, flickering a little bit. There's actually waves going on the water. But the thing is, you know, they're so far away and it's just looks like static. You know, but it flickers sometimes a little bit. So what it is just like a bum map. You know, a normal map on a flat surface. Right.
Oh, okay. So
and it's just it's fetching from an environment map. That's all it is. And the environment map contains the scene that gets reflected on the water. And it's static. It doesn't move ever. Not in this case anyway. Somebody's behind me. Pesky little stupid. So there was another thing. She's over here, which is the other kind of water. And this is like the conveyor belt. Right? You can see it's just the texture that's you know, that's moving the texture coordinates. That's all. It just has, yeah. Nowadays you see that and you're like, what? What? So yeah, no, this is better right here. It's better because it just does some reflection, right, of an environment map. Yeah, I mean, it's, they render the bottom of the water, okay, and then they render the surface. You know, especially a normal map that does the waves. And, fitting for an environment map. And then, yeah, there's actually another texture, which is just a, like, blur, cloudy kind of thing. Suppose it's supposed to represent the foam, you know. Oh, there's more over here. But, yeah, I mean, this is basic for today's standards. This is 2001, 10 years ago. So, okay.
Oh, yeah, no blades of grass. That's in that other one you were showing.
Hmm?
No blades of grass. That's in that other one you were showing.
Actually, there are little ones.
Oh, just a few.
Yeah. It's older hardware, I mean. Yeah. So, okay. Make sure I have a few things. Make sure that I don't forget anything I want to say. And show. Okay. Ba-doom. I'm going to cut off all the sound because it's annoying. Okay. This is the game project. Basically, as we last saw it, it contains a solution for the minimap thing that I posted, and also has a few more things that I added this last week. It's finishing to compile. Any day now. Okay. So, the thing. Okay. Probably even see it better from here. You see this wall? You see what happens to it in the distance? Becomes a little blurry. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I was looking for that setting to try to put it into my game because I saw it in Dan's game before.
What setting?
I never could find a setting to make the textures blur like that in the distance. I figured there might be.
Oh. Okay. So the reason for the blurring is the mipmapping. Remember mipmaps, okay? We have a texture, lots of detail in it. The problem is when the texture is kind of far away, okay, and each pixel on the screen could have any of a number of pixels from the texture, you get aliasing effects. And one of those things that you can see is when you move ever so slightly, okay, the pixels flicker. Because the pixel, each one of the pixels of the screen, you know, gets a pseudo random pixel from the texture. you know, from a certain area of the texture. So we get mid mapping, which is the same texture but at lower resolution, and lower and lower and lower. The idea is that for every pixel on the screen should correspond one pixel from the texture, mm-hmm. at some level of detail of the texture mm-hmm. on some mipmap. Okay. The problem with these pixels here is that they look like this. This is the wall, right? And if we have one pixel here on the screen, okay, it gets maybe, I don't know, let's say 4 pixels top to bottom from the texture, and it gets 64 pixels left to right. Why? Because of the perspective. Over here, the pixels in the texture maybe look like this. Over there, they look super, super thin. Okay, everything gets squished due to the perspective. So, roughly, okay, and this is all rough approximations, what GPUs do is calculate the area on the screen of one of the pixels in the texture and figure out, you know, a mipmap value from there. They take the area. The problem here is we only would want to blur like 4 pixels vertically, but 64 horizontally. Okay, and mipmaps are one size fits all. So GPUs tend to be conservative about this, and that's why it gets blurred. It's blurring basically 64 pixels in vertical also. So it's blurring pixels that would go over here and over here, it's blurring them into this pixel here. Make sense?
Did that JPEG include the mipmap?
No, but when those textures get loaded through D3DX, load texture from file or something like that, and you can tell that to create the mipmaps for you. You can create the mipmaps yourself if you want. Yeah, so that's probably because of the way the texture got loaded, possibly. You know, it got loaded without mipmaps. It's also possible that you are not bilinear filtering the texture, in which case, you know, it doesn't, I mean, it still filters them down, but then, you know, you can still see the pixels themselves of the mipmap. Anyway, so that's what happens. You know, you're supposed to get blurring in this direction, but you're also getting a lot of blurring in this direction that is completely unwanted. So there is one extra mode that fixes that. It's called anisotropic filtering. So let's try that out. Yeah. Okay, this did not blow my computer. I'm sorry to get rid of this one. Okay. I'm gonna do something stupid. It is not gonna work at all. I'm gonna do it anyway. Thank you. this thing booting. Okay, so the idea of anisotropic filtering is that the GPU will figure out and do the blurring manually. It is slower. What the GPU does is every time one pixel shader fetches from one texture that is anisotropic, it'll go and start looping and say, okay, I'm gonna get one, right? And then it figures out if it needs to get more, like above and below, you know, and it, you know, there's a setting which is the max anisotropy. You know, this is all in the sampler states. Okay, so there's a filter mode which is anisotropic, and then there's a state which is max anisotropy, which you can set all the way up to 8 or 16. You know, it kind of depends on the GPUs. Modern GPUs can do up to 16, which means it might actually loop fetching 16 times in order to get super duper quality. It is slower. So everything is a trade-off there. Okay. There is one mode of the hardware renderer that we used in the last homework. If you went through, you know, press space a few times, it removes the scene and instead puts this texture that goes like a back and forth. Okay, that's one way to experiment with filtering modes and addressing modes. Okay, so I just want to make sure that you are aware of those. You're aware of that little problem that lets you see what the effect is. Okay. For addressing modes, the only thing about them is they are all about what happens when the texture coordinates are outside of the texture. So we have a texture, and this is 0,0, and this is 1,1 as texture coordinates. What happens if I give it 1,000 for the X? You know, does it blow up or, and the answer is no. It depends on the addressing mode. Addressing mode says what happens with those texture coordinates. The typical ones, clamp and wrap. There's also the mirror one, which is an interesting one. So what's the utility of that? What do you think? Yeah, I mean, if you have a texture like this, okay. Say, texture that looks like that. Then over here, it would be like this. And, so this would be from 1,0 to, 2,1, right? Over here. So those coordinates would give you this texture, but mirror like this. And in here, it would be mirror like this. So what's the utility of having this?
The guy in the Halo game where it was half split, the texture was half split. And
that's one reason to do that. Typically that is done through just texture coordinates. I mean, there's nothing that says you can't repeat the texture coordinates of the left side on the right side. You can even repeat the geometry itself. The main use of this is to make sure that there are no harsh edges as you repeat the texture over and over again. And you can see that in that little program. The texture that I'm using there, you know, that photo of me with my sister, Especially the top with the bottom, you know, it's very different. So when you do wrap, you know, there is a very harsh edge between instances of the texture. Mm. When you do the mirror, there's no hard edge. Mm. So for instance, if you have a grass texture and you want to repeat it everywhere, right, maybe mirror is the way to go. Mm. Because you don't need to worry about the texture, you know, being kind of wrappable by design.
Oh, I see. You can see the edge as well.
Hmm?
You can see the dividing line between the textures as well.
It depends on the texture. I mean, say you have a texture that is flat yellow. You can't see the edge as you wrap it around, right? Well, same thing. You can design a texture that the top edge matches the bottom edge so that when you repeat it, you don't see any cracks. The conveyor belt is one example of that. Okay. Yes, yes. Everything is booting. Okay. Let's knock on wood. I don't want any more crashes. Hmm? I've actually done what you said. I think it was you. Turn off the Direct3D. Yeah. So hopefully that will take care of everything. Maybe Pix will work too. yeah, so basically Ben kind of found out that in his computer, Pix doesn't allow debugging the shaders unless the retail D3D is enabled. You know, with a debug, D3D doesn't work for some reason. So. Why? Who knows? Okay, so at least I can run it once. so here we have the scene graph and the world model file. It's the thing that renders the world. Okay. Hello? Okay. Now I'm worried. I'm not doing anything. Huh? Yeah, but the mouse doesn't even move, so. This is highly unbelievable. Okay, guys, I need to apologize about all this. There you go. Huh? Computer lab? Well, I have this computer, but I just don't know what it can do. If it can do anything. At least I can put slides in this one, if nothing else. Do they have Word Visual Studio 2005? Really? Mm-hmm. Okay.
The ones in the lab have 20.
Yeah. Okay. Let me re-reboot this one. I'll reboot it as many times as needed. Now I'm very, very pissed. Okay. So there's another experiment that I kind of intended to show you here. You know, first I intend to show you the anisotropic. Simple, little one-line change. That's all I need to do. Another one is the Z fighting. So the game project as it is, the one that Dan and I put there, has one bug. The debug camera doesn't get the projection matrix initialized. You get, you know, it just has the default one. Interestingly, if you lose the device, like, you know, you lock the computer or something and then unlock it, then it will recreate the correct projection matrix for it. but anyway, whatever. Basically, it has the Z range different, you know, kind of changed. So if you mess with it, okay, especially mess with the near Z plane, and make it very, very small. Say, you know, 1E5. Sorry, 1E-5. That's 0.00001 for the uninitiated. Then you'll see that as you move the debug camera around, you know, things flicker in and out. This is an example of Z-fighting. In that case, it's Z-fighting due to precision, lack of precision. Because the near Z-plane is so, so close, and everything is kind of an exponential curve. One single step of Z buffer values on the scene can actually be kind of large. Right? So whether a particular pixel gets one or the other depends on floating point. And again, you know, that changes as you move the camera around. So things do flicker in and out. It's just because they're rendered on the same Z plane according to the Z buffer. Because it has no precision left. Okay? One thing to always, always remember is that the precision of the Z buffer in the far plane depends exclusively on the ratio of between the two Z planes, the near and far plane. Okay. So if you have the camera here and the near Z plane is here and the far Z plane is over here, okay, that's going to be a very, very small number. But that makes it so that the Z values over here are maybe one here, another one here, another one here, another one here, and then they get progressively more more precise the closer you get. Okay? So just make sure that you always play with the near Z plane to push it as far as you possibly can. Okay, computer has booted again. For whatever reason, I feel compelled to try again. Okay. Hopefully this works. Now, I'm not gonna touch anything. I start Visual Studio again. Looks dangerous to me. Hello? Bang the hard disk. Coming up. Still not crashed. Well, if it crashes, I'm going to do something. And that is going to be to do a break and ask somebody to let me use their computer. How about that? Yeah, I'll just get this stuff here. This was working when we did this old stuff yesterday. Last week. The previous one. Okay. Yeah, now it's kind of parsing include files and doing all the IntelliSense stuff, I suppose. There. Okay. Yes. So this is the filter that I was talking about. What did I do here? Okay. And then there's another state, another sampler state called max anisotropy. Let's set it to 8, which is pretty good. And then hopefully run this. So, hope you can see the difference over here. Okay, we don't get this vertical blurring happening so much. It does get blurred eventually, because that's what mipmaps are supposed to do. Okay, they blend the texture into a smaller resolution. But it does look a lot better like this. Okay. Okay, there is actually, let me just run it. There's another thing I did on the game here, which I hope you can see. Okay, so you can see that there's some aliasing here on the around the edges of Tiny. elves are on the edges of the ball, and not so much elsewhere, just because the colors are pretty similar. Like, these colors and these colors are quite similar, right? So there is some staircasing up here, but it's not so pronounced as it is here. Mm. So one thing that I've done as an example of how to do full screen effects is a simple anti-aliasing filter. Okay, and you can see that work here. I don't know if you can tell the difference. You cannot? Okay.
Is it on now?
It is on now. Yeah. So let me show you like this. It's not the best anti-alias filter in the world. It is extremely tricky and impossible to do perfectly, kind of thing. But, you know, I just said, hey, I'm going to do one. So, and it's the first one I've ever done, and there you go. It is one example on how to do things in the full screen. I mean, part of the problem is that it doesn't detect all the edges. Another part of the problem is that maybe it's filtering too aggressively. So it does get blurry around the edges. So, let's see, what was this? On reset device. So another thing I've done is to get the game to render at the lower resolution so we can see those things a little clearer. Right now, I'm only using shaders here. Well, Tiny has its shader, right, for the animation, multianim.fx. And in here, I'm just using a couple of simple pixel shaders for these post-processing stuff. So in here, you can see all the aliasing, all the staircasing around Tiny a lot more easily, right? So when I turn this on, suddenly that sort of disappears to some extent because of the blurring. Okay. Hopefully you can see the difference better this way. The idea of this filter is just to detect when there is a edge that represents, you know, sharp contrast of colors on either side of the edge. So there are two things to doing full screen filtering like this. One of them is this. Basically, you need to create a render target. So this is creating a render target, right? There is also management that goes with the render target, like, you know, when the device is lost, get rid of it, and so on. Okay. This thing that says pull, D3D pull default, it's basically where to allocate this texture on. Okay, there is a managed pull. What that means is Direct3D will take care of everything. You cannot use that for render targets. It's just for real world textures that you load from disk. The usual texture that you just initialize once and then use it without changing it ever again. Okay, so those are best handled by managed, because when the device is lost, it keeps a copy of them, and then, you know, when the three comes back on, it'll do everything under the hood. This pull default means video memory, okay? Which is where you render stuff. So you do need to manage it. So, scene render target, let's see where it gets used. So this is our on-frame render function. This is the thing that renders the entire scene. Okay, so what I had to do is first get the render target and depth stencil surfaces, you know, basically what we're rendering into. Mm-hmm. That stencil is the Z buffer. So I get them so that I can, you know, because I'm going to swap them with something else, and then I'm going to restore it at the end. I'm actually not going to use a different dev stencil, but I could have. And then I set the render target to this scene render target. Okay. Set a render target requires a surface, so I have to get the surface from the texture and then set it in and then release it. You know, Direct3D owns one of those references now, so I can release it immediately. Okay. What this does is now I'm going to be rendering here. Instead of on the screen, I'm rendering off screen. Hmm? And that's how I could do that low resolution rendering, right? Because I can choose whatever size for the texture I want. And then everything else is exactly the same as before. There's no change whatsoever. Hmm? This is all the same. Render the scene and everything. Then once I'm done rendering everything, then I reset the render target to what it was before. And, you know, get rid of those. Always have to manage all those references. And then basically copy it onto the screen. And I just put those copy functions in a, you know, separate file. This is whether I do normal or with the anti-alias filter that I just showed you. Okay? So what this does is just puts the scene onto the screen. It's also clearing the Z buffer on the side, but anyway. This is all before rendering the minimap and before rendering all the XUT duals and all that. So it's just the 3D scene itself. Which is also nice because now I can have that 3D scene at a different at a different resolution. It's always the same one. And then just finish rendering the frame on the regular render target. Okay, so this is how it goes. Okay, doing full screen stuff. You need to get your scene into a texture, and then you will use that texture in a custom pixel shader. Any questions about this so far? What? Oh, Nikita Shamganov? Probably? That's an acquaintance. So, and the one that copies is just normal. It's pretty much almost copied from the software renderer. Taking a texture and copying it onto the screen. And it doesn't even use a pixel shader. The anti-alias one does use a pixel shader though. So, again, set the pixel shader. It uses some parameters, so I set them as a pixel shader constant. Okay.
So the sampler state variables still mean anything?
Yeah, sampler state is about how textures get sampled. What filtering, you know, mode, what addressing mode, all those things. Texture state states. Those are the ones that do not mean anything anymore when you're using a pixel shader. Okay. So, in here, I'm not using any texture state states. See, there's none. Up here, there are. I'm basically setting a pixel shader that says, get the texture, both color and alpha, and use that. That's it. To do something simple like that, you know, this is probably the simplest way. Okay. Now, the meat of this is in the pixel shader. So it uses the texture. S0 means set texture 0, right? That's the one. It uses a constant. It means set pixel shader constant F, because it's float. Zero. This is just the count, how many of them I have in the array. Okay. In this case, the pixel shader constant is the pixel increments. Okay, basically, how much do I need to add to the texture coordinates to move one pixel over on the X and on the Y? So it relates to the size of the texture. And this is what I'm doing. I'm getting 4 pixels. And this is one way of detecting edges. So this is the pixel that I'm rendering, right? So what I'm doing is I'm saying, hey, I'm going to get these 2 pixels and those 2. I don't need this one for now. So I'm going to get those pixels here. Okay, I'm going to subtract them. So positive X subtracted with negative X. So that's this minus this. Okay, I'm just subtracting the colors. The absolute value of that difference tells me whether there's a lot of change along the X in colors. Right here, it's just each component is being analyzed separately like this. And then I just do a dot product with 1, 1, 1, 1, basically adding them together. Probably doesn't matter. Probably faster. Probably, maybe. No big difference. No big difference. Style, exactly. Do you multiply and then add, or do you use the MAD intrinsic style? You know. For better or for worse, in computers, there's always at least 3 ways of doing anything you want to do. They're all different. So basically what I'm saying is, oh, take all the absolute values of these differences, add them together, and that's sort of a value, an indication of how much the colors are changing left to right. Same thing, top to bottom, how much they're changing top to bottom. So if I use those as the coordinates of a vector, okay, I get maybe colors are changing horizontally but not vertically. Okay, I get a vector like this. They're changing vertically but not horizontally. I get a vector like this. You know, they're changing in both directions. You know, then I get a vector like this. Okay. Oh, and that's one bug in the algorithm. Because you would want to not do the absolute values quite yet. But anyway. So I'm not getting those. And therefore, I'm not getting those. At all. Okay? Hindsight. Okay? But the thing is, you know, this kind of is a sort of detection of whether there is an edge around this pixel or not. If all the colors are the same, if everything is flat, you know, like everything is red, then I get, you know, nothing. Very small vector, if anything at all. Okay? Not only that, I'm assuming that this is the direction in which the change is more pronounced, which would be true if I weren't doing these absolute values over here. True-ish, anyway. Okay. So I'm also getting the edge direction. So if colors are changing in that direction, then it means the edge goes, you know, on this side. And then this is all, you know, just experimenting with numbers. Okay. Then I go through the mother lode of the filter. So I have a direction of the edge and direction of the gradient. And what I'm saying is I'm going to filter, you know, samples from the texture in, around this area. Okay. Because if there's an edge like this, then I kind of want to sample those and blend them together. And that's what gets, you know, the anti-aliasing sort of effect, blurring sort of effect going. Here I divide by 11 because I'm adding 11 samples. And that's a box filter. It's the simplest kind of thing. You know, it's just adding together and divide by the number of samples.
So it looks like you do the gradient direction as well.
Yeah. So the idea is not just to sample points here. I'm actually sampling points like here, right? A little bit on the left, on the side, on the right. That was all experimenting until I came up with something that seemed to anti-alias somewhat. Even if it's not the most highest quality thing ever. Okay. Interestingly, I created another filter. I call it the focus race. So let me turn it on and see what happens. And of course, we want full resolution. So this one you should like a lot more because it does more of what it's supposed to. So here we have the game as it's normal, and then I turn the filter on. Yeah, so. So it's a little like what I was showing you in Halo. Okay, it's blurring things in this direction. In this case, I'm not drawing the texture multiple times all over the screen, which I could have, you know, just render it like this and then bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And that would have worked. In this case, what I'm doing is just sampling from it several times while moving the texture coordinates inwards. So for a point like this, I'm getting texture coordinates from a line towards the center. Actually, it looks kind of cool. Like, I put a little factor so that the center of the screen doesn't get much in the way of blurring. You know, it's just on the edges of the screen. Anyway, that's just one of the ways of doing this sort of thing, this sort of effect. You will notice that it's everything in screen space. Okay, so when I'm far away from this wall, you know, this looks bigger in sort of world space than it is when I get closer. Same size on the screen, though. this sort of filter looks like this. So I sample the texture as if I were about to copy it, just, you know, output the color. And then I figure out the direction that I want to filter on. I could make this a horizontal, a vertical, or whatever. Put any complex formula on it. In this case, it's just the texture coordinates centered on the center of the texture, which is the 0.5 point. Remember, coordinates go from 0 to 1. So 0.5 is the center, and then I invert it so that it looks inwards instead of outwards from it. That's all there is. Multiply by its length, which is what gives me this area in the center that is a lot less blurred. Basically, in the center, the vectors are small, because this is proportional to the coordinates itself. So in the center, they are small. If I multiply by itself, then it gets even smaller, basically. And then I say the delta is 8 pixels. So on the edge of the screen, it'll go 8 pixels at a time. And then for any parts of the screen that are closer to the center, you know, it'll get smaller and smaller increments. And then I just sample a bunch of times and divide by how many. That's it. In many ways, these are two examples of, you know, a multi-tap filter. Multi-tap filter is basically sampling from a texture in various positions and doing some math with those positions. Let me show you something. So I've switched to the anti-alias filter. And what I'm going to do is get... basically, just get the edge direction and just render that in the red and green components. You know, that acts as a sort of experiment, right? It'll tell me... Ooh. One second. Sorry about that. So, what this is telling me is where the edges are, that it can see. You'll see there is red where it's vertical, there is green where it's horizontal.
And by edge, you mean color contrast.
Color contrast, yes. No, not geometric edge. In order to get a geometric edge, we have to do something like, instead of use the colors, use the depth map, the Z-buffer. You cannot access the Z-buffer directly, but you can render Z-values into a buffer.
I think fixed that way you do different channels, you could display and one was the depth buffer.
Yeah, you can display the depth buffer that you're rendering into in Pix, yes. But in general, Direct3D 9 does not allow you to use the depth buffer texture in GPU operations. in the 310 and 11, you know, it's possible. In the Xbox, it's possible. But running the 39. So there you go. I mean, you can see it's kind of following all the edges in color contrast. And that's basically where it's doing the filtering. There is no filtering going on here, for instance. There's no. So, pretty much the same color. Okay. So, and this kind of comes to show you that you can actually, even if you can't debug in PIX for some reason, because it doesn't always work, you can always get stuff out of your shaders. If you want to know what your shader is doing at some point in the middle, just make a color out of it and render that. And then you can see it like this. Do one last thing while this thing is working. Let's see, where was this? Purple? No, basically. Projection parameters. Okay. So this is a way of seeing that Z fighting that I was talking about. If you're sharp, you can see that there are pixels flickering over here on the little models over there. But yeah, it's easier to see things like this. You know, there's a portion of a wall that disappeared there. It's a kind of triangle like this. Especially when you move around, you can see things appearing and disappearing. Again, that's just math imprecision because we are on the limit of precision. Okay, so again, the main takeaway from this is to just be aware that we're operating with limited precision math, and you know we should be comfortably away from those limits of precision. I push it further, and it goes. Gets a lot worse. Okay. Big chunk. The aliens ate it. Okay. Questions?
Can you post those example pictures?
Are
you going to post those example pictures?
Yes. Going to post those example filters. I'm also going to post the hardware renderer source code. So with those two, you will have, you should have plenty of reference about rendering, about gamma correction from the hardware renderer, you know, how it's done in D3D9, that sort of thing. You know, how to hook up the shaders into your game, you know, some examples of that. More? No? Okay. Pause. Let's get back by 1 o'clock. Okay. Let's do a nice pause here.
Oh, I figured out why my old game was not blurring in the distance. I had the mid filter turned off.
Oh.
The mid filter property wasn't enabled.
It was point. Yeah, so it had mid maps, but it was not blending between them.
Well, I just tried it on this, and I just commented out that set sampler state mid filter linear.
Yeah, but what that does is not, you know, when
this line was the one that did it. So if you got rid of that, then in the distance.
Show
it,
me.
Sure. You see these moiré patterns on the.
Yeah. So it is not mapping at all.
Yeah, it's just rendering the
raw texture. Can I do something?
Sure.
This is probably default. None.
Yeah.
Which means do not use mipmaps. The alternative is this one, which is point filtering. With that, you do get mipmaps. They're just not.
Yeah, because you can see it's still blurry in the distance, so it's different than having none.
Yeah, it's still blurry, but you can see the step from one mipmap to the next, like right there, vertical line.
Oh yeah.
Which is not perfect, but better. Less aliasing.
So, yeah, previously I have enabled that because I thought, oh, my JPEG file don't have any bit.
Yeah, but it's not about what the file has in it. It's what the GPU sees. You know, there's stuff between the file and the GPU, in the video memory.
I didn't realize that.
So yeah. You know, you can create the maps as you load the texture. In a professional game, probably you wouldn't want to because it increases your load times.
Custom.
Then again, you know, it might be fast enough that you don't care. You know, it's kind of like decompression, right? you know, you create the mipmaps on the fly. Why not? Typically, that's not done. For whatever reason. I haven't seen it done much.
Do they sometimes make the mipmaps by hand so that they look exactly right?
Yes. So sometimes an artist will want to tweak the mipmap to make it better, much more what they want. One of the places where I've seen that done is in font textures. So textures that contain characters that you use for rendering text. Especially when those characters are Chinese characters. Exactly. So when you reduce the character, okay, so you they kind of look like this, right? You know, they have like different strokes and so on. And there's another one here, say, that's not supposed to touch. But, you know, when you blur it down, when you reduce the size and just automatically blend pixels together, it might end up kind of touching. Okay, so an artist might decide, hey, it's more readable if I manually separate them. So that's one reason why people might want to do that. Another one is, hey, you know, people have actually used bitmaps as a sort of, oh, I want to choose a texture. So, yeah, they kind of get the correct bitmap and rendered, and they don't, they don't auto-generate the bitmaps, you know, they all maybe look completely different. One way, for instance, is damage. So you have the high-resolution texture, which is the pristine texture for a car. And then the next bitmap is the car, but a little bit rusted, say. And then the next one is even more rusted and so on. But then you have to be careful how you use the texture, of course, because if the car is supposed to look pristine far away, then you still need to use the high-resolution texture somehow. So on occasion, people will do crazy things. Excuse me. Crazy things like that. But anyway, just... Pretty computer. Keep working. I need some water.
So, you've seen the game Portal, right?
Yes.
So is that one way to solve that problem, where you render from one view, render a scene from one view direction, onto a back cover, and then render the scene totally? And then
yeah. Yeah, that is one way. In the case of Portal, I actually wouldn't do it that way, but actually, maybe I would. The idea is, you can render a scene into a texture and then put that texture somewhere in your scene. You can render mirrors with that, and you can do that sort of thing. But in Portal, there is the case of you looking through a portal that's looking back at you, or looking through a portal that's looking back into the portal, which is looking back into the portal forever and ever. Okay. So what do you do with that? What you end up doing is something like, you know, if you have, say you have one portal here and the other one here. So when you're looking this way, you're also seeing another portal. And another one, okay, through it. I mean, this portal is the same as this one. Because when you look through here, you're actually looking through here. It's kind of mind-bending, right? So if you actually render the scene into a texture, then you can render into this portal the scene as it was last frame. And maybe you'll see just this portal, but you don't see anything through it, say. But then in the next frame, you'll render that, you know, like the current scene, a scene through here. Okay, so basically as frames go on, you know, you actually get a portal, right, which has everything, you know, like many, many iterations of itself. And that actually replicates the real effect. Like when you aim a camera at the TV, there is a certain delay. You know, it's a little like a whip. You know, that long tail of images, repeating images. It's a little bit like a whip, just a little bit. Just because, you know, the camera can only see the previous frame through it. So every step that you see inside of the image, you know, is the past. But yeah. Portal is a really cool game. I really liked it. It is fun. I don't know, I liked Mindbender, so.
I don't know, after the first time I saw it, it kind of made me disappointed.
It's a game.
Yeah. They combine a great
you play to have fun.
I mean, story. There's a unique concept.
Oh, I think yeah. The idea is very good, but with
There is no cake.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, you solve it once and then...
Mm-hmm.
Is my problem.
Okay, you solve it once and then that's it. Years later, you might want to do it again. And it might be reasonably fresh again. It's like watching a movie more than once. Why would you do it? But people do. I've done. Mm-hmm. Come on, gotta watch The Incredibles at least once a year, right?
The what?
The Incredibles.
Oh, yeah. Have you seen the short Jack Attack?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I hope nobody is disturbed by listening to the recording of my chewing. Okay. Let's continue. This was the hardware render. Wow, that's going slow. So, there's actually one thing that I'll show you here. Yeah, they're using mirror by default. I don't know if you see a little artifact that it's very elusive, but you can see it around, like, you know, the image cracks. It might be hard to see. Okay, I'll get a better example of that. So in here you can see the mirror, okay? Mirror, 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 and there are no cracks in the texture, ever. When I use the wrapping, you know, that you can see they got a big crack right here. And smaller ones on the sides, right? But this is the big one. So again, this is just, you know, you can experiment with the dressing modes here. very easily. The other thing that you can experiment with is the filtering modes. Ooh. We'll see it over here. Anyway. So the filtering modes just do the, you know, smoothing of the sort of animation quite a lot. Like, this is better. Okay. Hmm. Yeah. So in here, basically, through keys, you're, I'm just changing the filtering mode and the addressing mode. Okay. And here you can see that when I switch between those two frames, this one is blurrier than the other one. You can see it clear in my mouth, for instance, in the photo. But it's pretty much everywhere. Okay. That's because that's a sharp jump from one mipmap to the next. Okay. And, when I switch to trilinear, then the jump is not sharp anymore. And that's basically what it does. You know, it smooths out, the switch from one mipmap to the next. This here is the other addressing mode. Okay. Sorry, the other scene. And this one is just moving very, very slowly. You can see it down here, how this is moving up. Slowly. Okay. With point filtering, everything jiggles. Right? Okay. Just because, you know, when you move one pixel at a time and there is no perfect correlation between pixels and texels, then, you know, some texels end up wider than others. Okay. And where that split is kind of moves as I'm moving this. And yeah, this line just jumps. Boom. Boom. Okay. So. In this case, bilinear or trilinear is no difference because it's the same mipmap all over. There's no change in mipmap. Anyway. Just wanted to make sure I showed you that on the big screen. So unless you have good bilinear filtering, you know, never attempt to move things very, very slowly. One pixel at a time is the only thing that makes it look smooth. Okay. There you go. So I wanted to talk more about textures. I mean, you know a lot about textures already, but just wanted to cover everything that is interesting about textures in general. I mean, we know what they are, we know how to use them, but people out there have found very imaginative ways of using textures in GPUs. So. The main point here is that textures are just lookup tables, or just memory addressable by the shaders. It's memory addressable in some interesting ways, like the bilinear filtering that you get from textures, right? like the MIP mapping. And also like the different types of textures that are out there. But ultimately, they're just lookup textures. You use indices, which are texture coordinates. And you get data from them. And that data, quite often is colors, but it can be in, you know, other completely different things. This is a list of purposes for textures that have been used in games quite a lot. Albedo is what one of you called pigmentation. It's the texture that we all know. Its color is a material color that changes throughout the mesh. And as such, it's just multiplied to all the diffuse light components. When used as part of a lighting model. Okay. Gloss maps is the same thing, but for specular. There are materials that maybe only reflect green. Or only reflect in certain points of the surface, but not everywhere. And that's what gloss maps are. Specify how much of the specular you get. And how they're applied is multiply that to the specular component of the light model.
I suppose you could also change the specular power as well if you wish to.
Hey, you could have a texture full of specular powers. Yes. Why not? Normal maps basically contain normals. X, Y, and Z in concept are the coordinates of a vector. That's a normal vector. There is when you use textures for things like this, which can be positive or negative, you have to be careful though. You have to be careful because when you get bilinear filtering, that's a great thing, even for normal maps. But you need to represent positive and negative values so they are contiguous. So textures are meant to have only positive values. So you just have to bias them. So if a texture contains values from 0 to 1, you need to remap your normals, the components of your normals, which are normally between negative 1 and 1, into 0 to 1. When you store them in the normal map, and then when you fetch that, you need to undo the operation. Transparency maps, which is quite often the alpha component of the albedo, but it could be anywhere. Most things are just conventions here, right? Height maps are a very interesting concept. So the idea here is that a texture contains a sort of relief. An expression of relief engravings on the surface of a model. For instance, you could model a quarter coin, and you could just make a cylinder, you know, a very wide cylinder, which is what a coin is. And the actual engravings, where it says one quarter and all that, you know, the face and the reverse, you can actually map them with a normal map, or you can map them with a height map. And we'll see an example of that. There's actually one sample in D3D, which if it doesn't crash my computer, it actually runs in my computer. So, you know, I'll show you in a minute. Emissive maps specify color that comes out of the surface, not participate in the lighting model itself. It just gets added on top of everything, the glowy eyes or, you know, the panel of lights on the old-fashioned-looking computer, that sort of thing. You have light maps, which are pre-computed light values on a surface. Basically saying, hey, you know, you have the interior of this building, Okay, and as long as we don't turn on and off lights, and as a game designer, you may choose not to allow that, right? You don't need to calculate the light on every pixel. You can just pre-calculate it and store the result of calculating the light into textures and then apply those to the surfaces. Okay, that only works well for diffuse light, you know, for the diffuse component of materials. For specular, that's a completely different matter. But this is an old school kind of technique, and you know, you will probably have heard and know about it. Light maps typically are low resolution as compared to the actual textures map on the surfaces. So say that wall over there, well, it doesn't have a lot of detail. Let's say that wall over there, you know, let's say, you know, you map a texture on it and, you know, we want to map the painting and the thermostat and all that. And we use, say, 256 by 256 texture. Okay, the light map for that probably will not be any more than, like, 32 by 32. And that's probably too much. Why? Because, as you can see, the lighting on that wall doesn't actually change a lot. You know, it doesn't have very high frequency components to it. The light. Another interesting thing about light maps is that they need to be unique. I mean, you compute the light at this point in the scene, okay, offline, and you put in a texture that only applies to this wall, not to that one or that one, anywhere else. Okay. So it provides also an interesting challenge for designing models with light maps attached to them. Because you need to make sure that you have a set of texture coordinates that are unique in every point of the model. Normalization cube maps, I would not recommend using them nowadays, but there they are. You know, it's just saying, you know, you give it a vector, and it gives you the normalized version of the vector. Texture addressing modes, there you go, we've seen them. You have formulas here, in case you ever need them. In past years, I've actually made people implement a texture fetcher with all these stuff, but decided not to do this year. So be happy.
What's frac? What's frac?
Fractional part of. Oh, okay. So if it's 0.5, it's 0.5. Filtering, same thing. Basically getting a sample that's here as a weighted average between the adjacent pixels. And this is in one dimension, but in two dimensions it works the same. It's just bilinear.
How does a trilinear work?
Trilinear is in three dimensions, and the third dimension is the mipmaps. So you have the X and Y and which mipmap it is, right? And all three end up being a sort of coordinate. In fact, in Direct39 shaders, there are multiple instructions for fetching from textures. One of them is text2D LOD. And that one allows you to specify the mipmap as a floating point value, so you can actually get blending between mipmaps. So zero means the high resolution one, one means the next lower resolution one, and so on. There are a whole bunch of different ways of fetching from textures that are available there in HLSL. You have them in the documentation, I'm not going to go through them. 99% of the time, you just use the one. So mip mapping, we've seen plenty of it. types of textures we haven't quite seen. So, one interesting one is cube textures. This is the one that you would use to normalize a vector, for instance. Because this is six textures put as the faces of a cube. Okay, and they get fetched from a three-coordinate vector. So imagine a point at the center of the cube, okay, the three-coordinate vector points at one of the pixels of one of the faces. Okay, and that's what you get. Volume textures are just three-dimensional array of things, right? Instead of two-dimensional, it's three-dimensional. Okay. It uses a lot of memory. Okay. It multiplies like crazy. I've seen them used for a lot of good effect for things like mist. You know, like mist flowing on a terrain.
Is it also used for fur?
Hmm?
Or air?
Typically, you will only use... Yeah, no, not really. I mean, you could, but you would use a volume map when you want to map a, you know, when you want to map a triangle, you know, which cuts across all three dimensions for some reason in any arbitrary way. So, for instance, imagine that you have, you know, like mist on a terrain like this, right? We could create a cube of mist and then repeat it over and over all over the place. Then it doesn't matter whether I'm looking this way or this way or this way, I can always sample a sheet out of it that is parallel to the screen, perpendicular to the view direction. Yeah, 0 to 1, 0 to 1, 0 to 1, x, y, z. For the cube textures, it's negative 1 to 1, because you know, it's in any direction.
Usually for what are they used for the cube textures?
They're used for environment maps. Basically, what happens is you have a cube map that represents the light coming into a scene from everywhere, right? And it has some resolution, so it actually has detail in it. Like, if the sun is over there, then there are bright pixels in that direction, right? If there are mountains over there, then I can probably see more or less the shape of the mountains in the environment map. But in the end, it's just light coming in from everywhere down into the scene. When it comes from above, it's probably blue. If it comes from below, it's probably dark because there's no light coming in.
Instead of a cube, would you want to use a spherical or a half sphere?
Well, a cube is an approximation of a sphere. Okay. If you have a square, which is the 2D equivalent of a cube, okay, you can map the size of this square into the quarter arcs of a circle over there. And the same thing can be done on the sphere. Basically, you have a direction like that, and what it does is sample from here. You have a direction like this, and it samples from here.
Of course, you have parallax as you move, but if your cube is big enough...
Yeah, I mean, an environment map has no parallax in it. You need multiple of them somehow, and, you know, I've never seen that really. I mean, this is about light, okay? Mm-hmm. So, the idea is you somehow create, you know, what's the light coming in from everywhere. Then, when you have a surface, this is the normal on the surface, okay? If I want to do diffuse light, for instance, okay, I just take that normal and sample from the environment map. Done. One way. If I want specular light, I get the view vector. I reflect that around the normal. Okay. And use the result to fetch from the environment map. And that simulates metal really, really well. Especially when the environment map is very nondescript. You know, it's just blurs. Like silvery blurs, grayish blurs. Okay. Yellowish blurs if you want to simulate gold, for instance. Or maybe it's just grayish blurs and you tint them yellow. There are other types. There are one-dimensional textures, which is just, you know, one-dimensional, basically just a straight array. And there are also arrays of textures, which are kind of like cube maps, but not quite. Those ones, basically, you cannot map across slices, you know, across elements of the array. When they get mipmapped, you know, like each element of the array, if each texture in the array gets mipmapped separately. When you have a cube map, you know, the whole thing gets reduced down in every single dimension and blended together. Make sense? And I think to be aware of is texture format, you know, you could have integer or floating point values in your textures. I mean, the classical texture is the 8 bits per component, right? But that's not the only possibility. In fact, it's very useful to use sometimes floating point when you're doing like shadow mapping and things like that. I mean, I've recently had to do some interesting things with a Z buffer, so I kind of rendered all the Z values into a floating point texture. And that works pretty well. You also can have signed or unsigned values. When you see that it says UV instead of RG and B, UV, W, those are signed. They're meant for storing normals in them. In that case, you don't need to bias them. Because the format itself understands that they can be negative. So they blend through the zero. They can be small or large components. You know, there are sometimes textures that you can find, like, two bits for alpha and 10 bits for red, green, and blue, which fits in 32 bits. Just gives more precision to the color. Some formats have no alpha. You have, for instance, the 565. That's 16 bits per pixel. Gives 6 bits to the green. Because that's the one that our eyes are most sensitive to, and 5 bits to red and blue, and that's 16 bits. There's no space for the alpha. When you have no alpha, you know, it defaults to 1. In fact, when you don't have a component, it typically just defaults to 1. Okay, so when you fetch from the texture, you can actually get the value, but it's just the 1 always. Okay. Some textures are compressed, especially the lossy codecs, which are DXT1, DXT2, DXT3. Okay, what those do is get a 4x4 block of pixels, basically divide the entire texture into blocks of 4x4 pixels. And each block of 4x4 pixels is it's encoded so that all the pixels are kind of codependent. Typically what they do is they set up 2 colors. And then each pixel can be any point in between those 2 colors. So all the pixels in there are within a line inside of a three-dimensional cube of colors. Palettes, which is the pixels in the texture are just an index into an array of colors. Okay, those are very old-fashioned and not really used anymore. YUV or UYVY or, you know, they get multiple names. Those are typically used for video encoding, but they can be also useful because they give more weight to the luminosity and less to the color. The way those are typically encoded is they have two eyes or four times as many luminosity values as they have colors. So multiple pixels, say in a 2x2 square, they all have the same color, it's just different luminosity. You can't have a red and another one green. And that would be done by having six values. Four for the luminosity and two for the two axes of color. The translation between like YUV type colors and RGB type colors is just a matrix, 3x3 matrix, that's all. Actually, well, 3x3 with translation, so 4x3. And then you have gamma, which, you know, I've already talked about some. You know, you're going to have textures that, when sampled, you know, d-gamma operation is done on them. To extract linear values that can be used in lighting calculations. So with the texture coordinates, there's also not much to say about. Coordinate wrapping is an old concept that, you know, people bumped into when they started using 3D and then they kind of hacked around it. The idea here is what happens if I have a cylinder, right? And that cylinder is, say, mapping, you know, like a map of the Earth, right? So we have a map of the Earth with, America over here and, Europe and Africa and Asia over there. Yeah, very, very badly drawn. And I mapped that around the cylinder, right? So when I look at the cylinder from above, okay, what I have is pixels like this. Sorry, vertices like this. Okay. So, let's say America is over here and, it goes all the way to Asia. So I have like a zero, I have a 0.5, you know, for the x-coordinate here, over here, it goes to 0.8, and then it goes all the way to 1. Or not quite 1, but almost, right? 1 and 0 is actually, you know, as I wrap it around, 1 and 0 are the same. You know, they have to match, right? And that is a problem because it means that I actually have to duplicate the vertices over here, where the transition happens. I have to duplicate the vertices because they cannot have the same texture coordinates. So, but people said, well, we don't want to do that. You know, back then memory was at a premium, right? And, so they actually figure out a way to say, hey, you know, if I have a triangle that has like, say, two vertices here, another one here, okay, then the GPU is going to go on a limb and assume that by saying this, it actually means this, right? So it can actually map across the divider. That's texture wrapping. Those are in like render states, wrap 0, wrap 1, wrap 2, wrap 3, wrap 4, and so on and so forth for each of the texture coordinates. Okay, you can turn it on and off. I wouldn't even worry about it, but you can see it, and therefore now you more or less know what it's about. Okay? If you use shaders, then it doesn't even, this is just fixed function, right? It's when the GPU decides what to do with which texture coordinates. When you have a vertex shader, then it's your job. Plain and simple. Also, as fixed function, you have coordinate transformations, which is a matrix applied to the texture coordinates. Uh, That's really all I have about textures. The most important thing about this is to just be aware of all the different types of textures that there are. Environment maps and albedo maps and gloss maps and all that. Okay. Especially if you really get into the industry, you know, you need to be able to talk about them probably. The other thing that I wanted to go through fairly quickly is about more stuff about quality. And the first part of the class, I was basically trying to show you things. Okay, you know, this is going through all the different options that there are and different things that people have done. First one is anti-aliasing. We talked about coverage-based anti-aliasing. That's multi-sampling. It's implemented in the rasterizer. The rasterizer does special things. It uses more memory for the rendered target. And then there's a post-process that blends nearby samples together to get an anti-aliased result. It is extremely popular today. And the thing is, multi-sampling is just the simplest version of it. Multisampling is where you run the same amount of pixel shaders or a little bit more because of the rasterizer extra samples that it finds. And then it's just using more memory. But there are actually other ways that people have been experimenting with. One that was kind of interesting is the A-buffer. The A-buffer is basically saying, hey, wherever I have a pixel, instead of just having a color, what I have is the head pointer of a linked list of pixels that have been rendered into the, versions of that pixel that have been rendered into this position in the render target. Okay. Of course, you know, having the head pointer of a linked list might not be very GPU friendly, but the end result is actually pretty good. The idea is that if I render a triangle like this, all the pixels that are in here, all these pixels, okay, inside of the triangle, they are covered by the triangle completely, fully. Okay, so they just get slammed. It's just a color. But any pixel along the edge gets stored as one of many. So when I render another triangle behind it, you know, another background behind it, okay, this background rendered this pixel. Now, this triangle also rendered this pixel. So what it stores is the color that was rendered and also the coverage, an expression of which part of the pixel was covered by a triangle. In this case, this portion over here. But not the rest. The idea is that after rendering all the triangles and ending up with most pixels on the rendered target being just one color, but some of them having multiple entries in the linked list because of partial coverage. It goes through those and resolves what the final color should be. And that gives you the benefits of the multi-sample anti-aliasing, but with high resolution on the actual pixels that need anti-aliasing. When you do multi-sampling, like 4x multi-sampling means that you have four samples here. In this case, there could be an expression of what it is, the coverage. Or maybe a bit mask with like 16x or 32x or something like that.
So with this A buffer, you probably weight it by the percentage of the pixel that covers?
So yeah. You weight them with the percentage of the pixel that covers and is visible. Like, for instance, say there was another triangle over here that was also visible like that. Then you get this big portion of the color of this triangle, and then a small portion of the color of this triangle, and then another small portion of the background. Okay. When the background was rendered, maybe it covered everything, but it's behind, so. And the idea is that this is all a post-process. So most pixels are fast. Some of them are slow because it has to walk a linked list. To calculate the final color for the pixel. But only for a few. Only for those edges that need anti-aliasing. So, and only uses a little more memory. Because it only needs extra memory for those. I mean, it probably stores like a bit or something for each pixel saying whether it's a color or it's the head of a linked list. Right?
So in the case of the front triangle, we would just throw out everything else that was in the A buffer.
Yeah,
I mean, the front triangle covers the
pixel completely. We render all that, and there is a linked list with three entries here, and then we render another triangle here that, like something like this, that completely covers the pixel. So we remove the linked list and just put a color, because everything has been overridden at that point. Maybe. Yes? Because it's not very GPU friendly. You know, it's not so easy to make a GPU that does all this. I mean, walking linked lists is not the best thing to implement in the hardware. Now, for instance, there are implementations done with compute shaders or CUDA for NVIDIA chips, right? And so basically, that's basically shaders that do not participate in rendering. They're not vertex shaders. They're not pixel shaders. They're just computations being run, okay? And so CUDA, for instance, NVIDIA, for instance, has this CSAA, you know, which I believe is powered by the CUDA architecture, which is something similar to a buffer but without so much linked list stuff.
Does
that change anything about how you render objects as alpha? One thing with a buffer, for instance, is that if you render something that's alpha blended, you know, it might just get added to the linked lists. But then suddenly you have lots of linked lists for a big triangle, maybe. Okay? Which is not very friendly to the hardware either. So it's not friendly for performance. But it allows you to render all the transparent stuff without regard to sorting. Because it basically adds it all to a linked list, right? And then the post-process will take care of it. We'll figure out what goes where. And how it gets blended. Okay. It is definitely a possibility. Maybe not the best. Yes.
And the triangle edges, there are edges, right? That's why you use anti-aliasing filter to remove those edges.
Yes.
So in this case, you have to interpolate these two triangles, the results from these two triangles and the edges, or you just override one over the other, or?
When rendering this triangle, okay, one of the pixels that it touches is this one, but it only touches a portion of the pixel, a portion of the area covered by the pixel. So instead of just storing a color there, overwriting whatever was behind, it respects what was behind, just adds basically a note in a linked list, right, in a data structure, a note saying, I touched this pixel, but not completely. So it basically defers all decisions until later. Once everything is rendered, then it goes through all those linked lists and figures out exactly what was visible, what wasn't, and what the final color, blended color should be between all the different things that touch the pixel. And that's where you get the anti-aliasing. Okay. I mean, anti-aliasing is a form of blending. It's a form of mixing colors that need to get mixed. They need to get mixed because the pixels got hit only partially. By one triangle and partially by another. Or maybe by five of them. Okay, so Another method of anti-aliasing that's kind of interesting is edge anti-aliasing. This was available on the first Xbox. It's not available on the 360, but it can be kind of sort of emulated. What this means is saying, hey, I want to render my geometry, but I want to render only the edges of my geometry. So if it touches this pixel completely, then I don't want to render it. If it touches this pixel partially, then I want to render it, but I want to alpha blend it, you know, with the amount of coverage of that pixel as the alpha value. Hmm. This is done as a post-process. So what happens is you first render everything without anti-aliasing. So you get all the jaggies and everything. And then you render everything over again in this special mode. Hmm. So when rendering on top of this pixel, it'll get render for this triangle, and it'll get rendered for, you know, the other triangle on the other side, and basically for all the triangles that were partially covering this pixel. Okay. Of course, it's not just this pixel. It's pixels that are, especially pixels that would not have been touched when rendering on them. So, especially pixels all around the edge. And so what the GPU does is it calculates alpha values depending on that coverage and just renders in there with the alpha blending. Okay. And what it does is it puts in there a mixture of colors for the different triangles that were partially covering it. And that does some alpha blending. Some anti-aliasing. Okay. Again, it's a bit of an old school type of thing. Modern GPUs don't really do this. They prefer multi-sampling. Everything ultimately prefers multi-sampling. One big disadvantage of this is you need to render everything twice. You need to run all your vertex shaders twice. Your pixel shaders are not hit so much, but your vertex shaders go twice. And another one is full screen post process filters, which I showed you one, and some of you didn't like it. And you didn't like it because, well, yeah, they are not quite satisfactory in general. Okay, it's not easy to take an image and anti-alias it without distorting it or breaking it in some way. Okay. It's just not easy. Exactly. That is precisely the reason. The most important information that would allow you to anti-alias perfectly is gone. Completely. So yeah, full screen filters are the only thing that's fully comprehensive. You know, they can anti-alias like jaggies instead of triangles, for instance, you know, when a texture is actually, like, a texture that's not mid-mapped, for instance, you know, they can kind of smooth it out. So they're the most comprehensive things. The edge and the coverage anti-aliasing, okay, they only improve the edges of the triangles. Anything else is just not improved at all. For instance, one thing that they do not improve is when you have alpha testing. You know, the edges around the alpha tested geometry, like, you know, blades of grass or leaves or things like that. They will just not anti-alias around that. Furthermore, edge anti-aliasing will not anti-alias when you have two triangles that cut into each other, which is still pretty common out there. Okay. The intersection between the two will not be anti-aliased. With multi-sample anti-aliasing, you know, with coverage anti-aliasing, typically they are. They are because the Z-buffer is also high resolution. So every sample gets its own Z value. Then the other catch is the coverage anti-aliasing, you know, messes with the rasterizer in some ways that can be nasty. You can have a game that looks perfect and you add anti-aliasing and suddenly it doesn't look so good. Again, that's just because suddenly it's hitting pixels that it wasn't before. And probably because you're not using Centroid, right, where you should, or vice versa. Another thing that's sometimes very useful is multiple render targets. You can output multiple colors from your pixel shader, and they all go to different render targets. Those render targets have to be the same resolution. Oftentimes, depending on the graphics chip, they have to be the same bit depth or format. Okay. The common restriction is that they have to be the same bit depth. So you can't have a render target that has 32 bits per color and another one that has 64 bits per color. Okay. So with those, you can hold up to 16 values. Okay. And you could use a lot of memory when you're render targets. But they can be kind of useful sometimes. It allows you to render the same thing twice in different ways, for instance, without having to process all the vertices twice. You cannot use it, for instance, for 3D, stereoscopic 3D, or things like that. I mean, stereoscopic 3D, you know about that, right? It's all over the movies nowadays. It's where you wear the glasses and all that. And what happens is there are two, for each frame, there are two images. One for the left eye, another one for the right eye. And the cameras are slightly different. You know, the point of view is slightly different. And your brain knows how to use that to see the 3D. Because that's how the eye...
I don't have a headache when I see 3D images like that.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that, but some people do. I mean, part of the problem is... The focusing, okay? So you're looking at something that's, say I'm looking at Jesse, okay? My eyes are looking, both of them are looking straight at him, so they're kind of pointing inwards, and they're also focused on that distance. However, when I have a screen a whole bunch of feet away, okay, and the screen... You know, that's the typical pointy thing that comes out of the screen at me is like this. Okay? Then I'm kind of very cross-eyed looking at this, but my eyes have to be focusing on the screen, which is way out there. Okay? And by focusing, I mean figuring out which part needs to not be blurred. You know, what's the distance that needs to be sharp? The image is over there. So that's what needs to be sharp. So our brains are not built to do that, to look here but focus over there. Okay, so and some people adjust better than others. That's basically all there is to it. And also, you know, movies are still being filmed at 24 frames per second. I don't know why. I find it ridiculous. Completely and absolutely ridiculous, but hey. Yeah. I mean, TVs have been at 60 frames per second forever. But movies are 24, so whenever you see, you know, a movie being, you know, doing a pan and everything's kind of shaky, you know, while the camera is panning around or moving around, then that's the 24 frames a second. And it hurts me because, you know, when you're trying to match two images and so on, that's even worse. Okay? The shakiness is different for each eye, maybe, or, you know, it's just, bad.
It would be hard to change the standard.
Yeah, I mean, The thing is, you know, what I've heard is that, yes, they know about this, but they don't want to fix it because when they make movies at 60 frames per second, it looks like telefilms. Looks like made for TV. You know, they don't have this movie quality to them. And people don't like that, apparently. Yeah, so there you go, reality check. You know, we're not built for... Anyway.
So did you say that you can use the multiple targets for the 3D?
You cannot.
Can.
You cannot, because every triangle has to be rasterized to exactly the same pixels on both images for the multiple rendered targets. Okay, and that's precisely what 3D is not. 3D means that each image, you know, has the same triangles, but they found different pixels because they were rendered with different view matrices. Okay. Well, not simultaneous, one after the other. Yeah. Well, I guess you could do simultaneous. You know, set render target over there. You know, draw primitive. Set render target over there, draw primitive. But I wouldn't recommend it. Set render target can be very, very expensive, depending on the chip. On the 360, it means a copy of the entire render target. So, there you go. Very. Deferred rendering is something that I mentioned in one of the classes. So it's another one of those things where they use this multiple render target thing to render all the data into multiple render targets first, and then do the lighting calculations afterwards, once per pixel. So it's just one pixel shader that covers the entire screen and just does everything. Okay, once per pixel. So there's not really that much more to do about it. Sometimes with deferred rendering, you know, they render the lights sort of incrementally, right? When you have a point light, maybe it only covers a portion of the screen. So, you know, you don't need to do that light for the entire render target. You know, you can just do a quad that covers that and do only that light. You know, because lights are additive, accumulate. So you can just render one light into a buffer and another light into the same buffer, adding, and so on and so forth. And everything that does not get rendered, okay, hopefully gets some ambient or something, you know, because it wasn't covered by a light. You know, but it's great for having like 50 point lights all over the scene, and, you know, it's actually reasonable in performance. So again, you know, it's just three steps. You know, first render all the geometry, then do the lighting pass, and then the transparent stuff has to be done, you know, after everything else. And the thing that allows you to do that is, you know, the first step generates the Z buffer, and then the other ones just use it. Right, that same Z buffer. Just be aware that this doesn't work very well with anti-aliasing. It's one of the nasty corners of it. Okay. The problem is that with anti-aliasing, you want to use centroid. And, you know, centroid means that your pixels get sampled at, weird places. You know, not in the center of the pixels. Basically, with multi-sampling, you don't really have centers of the pixels so clear. Another reason is that what happens when you render like normals and then you get them blended, right? They're not normalized anymore. You have to be careful about that. Your normals can actually go out of whack around the edges of your meshes, especially when the triangles are kind of edge-on. And you need to render normals here. So you have to put in heuristics to say, oh, you know, I don't like this normal, that sort of thing. Yeah. Honestly, I have never done this, so I don't know all the gotchas. But
seems like a good anti-aliasing by super sampling.
Super sampling, yes, no problem. No problem. But then again, you know, that's a lot more work. A lot more pixels to deal with. Mm. Super sampling in step one would be awesome. Perfect. Super sampling in step two, not quite so. multi-tap filters, you know, this is basically, I showed you an expression of one. In here, you know, you have it as nested loops, you know, for the X and Y. Basically what it is sampling the texture at multiple places and then doing some math with them. That math, the most standardized way to do that math is to have a kernel, which is basically a two-dimensional array of values, okay, which specifies what to do with each sample around the point that we are rendering. Hmm. Okay. So, for instance, one filter that's kind of interesting looks like this. So the kernel has 0.5 here, 0.125, 0.125, and 0.125, and 0.125. Okay. All of the coefficients in the kernel should add up to 1, so that, you know, this is something that looks like the sample, right? Unless you're doing something very wacky. Okay, so I'm not going to get into that. In this case, this is a blurring filter. You know, you repeat it over and over again, and things blur in sort of circles. Okay, it's like a Gaussian filter. Okay, this would be 0, 0, 0, 0, so you don't sample them, hopefully. Hmm. Another one that's interesting is... So you do 2, and then this one's RL set to -0.25, and so on. Okay, and that's a sharpening filter. It sharpens your image. You know, you can try it if you want. It's kind of fun. Okay. What happens is, you know, I get, it basically enhances the edges, you know, by using these negative, coefficients. Okay. And those are all just 5-tap filters. Okay. And here I have like a 25-tap filter with a loop and, you know, 25 values in this kernel. Right. And I mean, you can go apeshit with this, but you can't really do a lot more than 25 in model 2.0. I mean, the pixel shader has a limit of, I think it's 64 instructions. So, you know, there's a limit to how much you can do. But, when the filter is symmetric like this, you can, you know, very typically you can just do it in 2 passes. Okay, so you can do first the horizontals. You know, you take a texture, render into some other one texture. You do the horizontal, okay? And then you use that texture that you just rendered into as a texture, and you render into the other one, you know, in vertical. And they add up to something kind of like this. Not exactly this one, I believe, you know, if you use something like in the horizontal... 0.25, 0.5, and 0.25, right? Or a 3-tap filter on the horizontal and then same on the vertical, then you get actually small values here. The equivalent of, right?
You said there is a limit.
limit to, because you only had 64 instructions in the pixel shader?
Yes, in Model 2.0.
Okay.
Your GPU might support Model 2.0, in which case, you know, you can have a lot more.
But I would think you could still have, you know, say, you know, a 10 by 10 tab filter. You're just changing Y and X three different values.
Yeah.
And then the tab filter would just be bigger array.
Yeah.
Okay.
And of course, you know, the way I have it there, it doesn't quite work because I'm like sampling. I mean, a texture goes from 0 to 1, right? The coordinates. So I'm sampling negative 2, negative 1, 0, 1, 2. Yeah. You know, they should be multiplied, you know, like, divided by the resolution of the texture.
Right.
Which you pass in as a constant, like I did in that filter over there that I showed before. Okay. And then dependent reads from the scene. Well, you know, that's one example. Again, you know, when you try to anti-alias the image. you know, you just sampling from it. Another thing that you can do is to have a texture that contains like displacement vectors. With that, you can distort the image in any way you want. Those vectors specify how the image gets distorted. That's very useful, for instance, to render things like drops of rain on the camera. You know, like simulate that sort of effect. Okay. Huh? Yeah. Many games have done it. The craziest one was one of the Metal Gear Solid on the PlayStation. You know, they just went apeshit with the weather effects. vaguely remember. Anyway.
Is that how they do that black hole working sometimes seen in screensavers?
That what?
And some screensavers, you see this kind of black hole warping the scene very strongly.
Well, you know, screensavers, I don't know how they're done, really, but yeah. You can do that sort of thing that way, yes, of course. Okay. And then here's one explanation on how you would do a bloom filter. So one thing about the bloom filter is first extract the parts of the scene, of the image that have high luminosity. Somehow. Okay. One of the ways is, you know, just find anything that's, saturated color. Right?
Zero
out everything else. And then the idea is you take that image, which is very basic, right? You know, it's basically black with brightness in it. And then you blur it and blur it and blur it and blur it. Okay. You don't use one single blur filter because it would be lots and lots and lots of taps. But if you repeat one filter multiple times, you know, you get the same effect multiple times. And it kind of multiplies. Another thing is because we are blurring it, the information in that image, you know, gets very, low frequency. Okay. Which means you don't need all the resolution. So you should use smaller resolutions. You know, down to like 160, 80, you know, that sort of resolution on the final blur image. Another thing that's interesting about that blurring is you should be expanding the parts of light into the parts that are darker. Okay, so you should never darken any pixels.
Now, was that we got the flare around the lights from Halo Reach?
Yes. Yeah, that is a
boom filter. So then how do you apply it to the image? You just add the two images together?
Basically, you get the high contrast image, you blur it,
yeah.
Okay. You end up with a very blurred image, and then, yeah, you just add it on top of your scene. I mean, ideally, it should end up being not very obnoxious, kind of, you know, washing everything out kind of thing. You know, I mean, exactly how you apply it and, you know, what looks best, it's very much art dependent, but.
Your render targets needed to be the same resolution. Do you not multiple render targets need to be the same resolution?
Yeah, but this is not multiple render targets. Well, it's multiple render targets, but not in the same draw call. So what you're doing is, you know, you have your image, okay, of your scene, then transfer that into a high contrast render target. Okay, this is high contrast. And then you blur that into some other target, probably smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And then you blur that into some other target, smaller. And then you blur that again. Mm-hmm. And then you take this. Yeah, of course, you map it on the entire scene. Mm-hmm. And you add it. You know,
so this is a post
top.
Process, not a
so this is, yeah, this is a post process completely. Of course, you know, you could have this many rendered targets, or you could just say, oh, I'm gonna blur that this back in here because, you know, don't need the contents of this anymore. So you just, you know, make a viewport that just renders into that portion, and, you know, you just need to make sure that when you sample from it, you know, you sample the correct portion of it. Just twiddling the texture coordinates. Or you can have as many render tags as you want. You know, memory is free and infinite, right? So, there you go. We are way over already, so. So that's basically all I have for today. The homework is for you to add lighting to your game. And also add some sort of effect. Something, you know, full screen post process, bloom filter, anti-aliasing done right, whatever. Okay. You could, like, you know, put some normal maps and per pixel lighting if you wanted. That's fine with me. Okay. But the basic thing is to make sure that everything is lit correctly. Everything you're seeing. No shadows. We haven't talked about shadows yet. That will be a topic for a different class. And believe me, it takes the entire class. So, one thing that I'm asking you to do, and I have the details written in the website, but, I'm asking you to send me your proposal of what you're gonna do to your game project. Okay? Which is basically to write it down. You know, to think about it, okay, I'm gonna do this. And write it down. Yeah, for the lighting and, you know, whatever else you are planning to do to it. Because you are, right?